Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emmanuel in this important work, click on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
So we should be going on to reason number 22, but instead, I wanted to go back and address something that we covered last week in a little bit more detail. Because I got really curious as we were going over the material last week. And that was the matter regarding, you remember this issue in Matthew, where the Gospel of Matthew cites a text and says it's written in the prophet Jeremiah, but when we looked up the text, it said, it actually wasn't from Jeremiah, it was from Zechariah. So, we all remember that?
Yeah.
All right, let's go revisit that over in Matthew chapter 27. So this was from reason number 20, where Asher Norman says that the stories of the betrayal of Judas are not consistent. The story is highly conflicted and lacks credibility. And, you know, that may or may not be the case, but at any rate, this is kind of a credibility problem on some levels, that Matthew doesn't even seem to know what prophet he's quoting when he's saying this would happen to fulfill what was written in the prophet such and such. But we find this story in Matthew 27. And just to get an overview of it, because this is the only thing we're going to do tonight, I want to read through the whole passage. It says, "Now when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and led him away and delivered him to Pilate the governor. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, 'I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.' But they said, 'What is that to us? See to that yourself.' And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed and went away and hanged himself. The chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, 'It is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood.' And they conferred together, and with the money they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." All right, that's our Matthew text. Now, Asher Norman said, he pointed out that the text that Jeremiah thinks, or Matthew thinks he's quoting from Jeremiah, doesn't say this at all. But Asher Norman did not point out that it was a text from Zechariah in the book. So maybe he didn't know that it was a text. It was actually a text from Zechariah. He simply pointed out that there is a passage about Jeremiah buying a field, and it's in Jeremiah chapter 32, and it doesn't say anything like what Matthew has here. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at both of these two passages. The one that Matthew thinks he's quoting, apparently thinks he's quoting, and the one that he is quoting. We're going to look at these two passages and get a little overview of them. So we'll start with the Zechariah passage that he actually is quoting. And we find this in Zechariah chapter 11. This is an important section of Zechariah for the early believers, There's a lot of prophecies that come out of these last chapters of Zechariah. These are very messianic prophecies, apocalyptic prophecies. And so the early believers looked to these chapters of Zechariah for insights into their situation. I think we'll start reading We'll start reading at the top of the chapter. Zechariah 11, verse 1. Open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar is fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. There is a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is the sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined. This passage, I wanted to start at the top of the chapter to give you a little feeling of how the sages would interpret such a passage. What are we talking about here? Lebanon corresponds to the forest land. That's the forest land north of the land of Israel, the Lebanon range. And Zechariah is addressing political situations and that sort of thing. But when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was called to the temple in the year that the master died, because the temple doors kept swinging open of their own accord, he rebuked the temple doors with this passage, saying, "Temple, temple, why do you frighten us with your counsel? I know what's written about you," where it says in Zechariah, "Open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars." And so he rebukes the temple, saying, "We already know you're going to be destroyed." You see, the temple, in rabbinic parlance, is sometimes called Lebanon because Solomon paneled it with cedars from Lebanon. And so he makes this is a huge leap to apply this text completely out of context of Zechariah to the temple. But he was spot on accurate. That is indeed what was happening. The temple doors opening 40 years before the death of the master was signifying the coming destruction of the temple. So that's Yochanan ben Zakkai and how he looked at this. And the only reason I bring it up is to give you an example of how the prophets were being read in the first century. Yes?
I'm sorry, when were these doors opening?
They began to open like that, to swing open like that, 40 years before the destruction of the temple. Yes, so it would have begun in the year that the master died. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you said they were going of their own accord. How long did that last?
I don't know how many times it happened. It happened more than once. It's recorded both in the Talmud, religious sorts, and in a secular history. Josephus records it as well. And so it was one of the miracles, one of the signs that God was doing in that last generation. Anyway.
Was there a common interpretation of what?
Yes. Yes. Josephus remarks that the light-headed among the populace took it as a good omen and said, "God is opening for us the gates of happiness." But the sages knew better. So, yeah, Josephus says that, and of course that would probably be a reference to Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now, ben Zakkai knew better, not only because of his reading of Zechariah, but because he was among the disciples of the Master. I mean, I don't know that he was a disciple of the Master, but he was at least among them. He heard the teachings of the Master. He was in the temple when the Master was teaching. He would have been there. He would have heard. And he seems to have a lot of respect for the teachings of Yeshua, and that he oftentimes presents similar ideas. Anyway, that's all. I bring all of this up only to show you how the prophets were being read in Judaism of the first century, and this kind of the loose way that they could be reinterpreted and reapplied to the current situation that the Jewish community found itself in. We'll keep reading this Zechariah 11 passage. "Thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter." So we think of that last generation. "Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished, and each of those who sell them says, 'Blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich,' and their own shepherds have no pity on them. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I will cause the men to fall, each into another's power and into the power of his king, and they will strike the land, and I will not deliver them from their power. So I pastured the flock doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock. You have to remember the master's teachings. I am the good shepherd, and he's all the other shepherds who came before me were thieves, you know, and these sorts of teachings are being informed by this text. And I took for myself two staffs. The one I called favor, the other I called union. So I pastured the flock. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul was also weary of me. I have no idea what that's talking about. Then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. What is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh. I took my staff favor and cut it in pieces to break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. I'm confident that this is speaking of that last generation, the generation that the master warned of, this wicked and perverse generation, this doomed generation. All these things will come upon this generation. So he says, then those who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Who's the potter in the house of the Lord? Here's an interesting thing. There's a textual variant, or perhaps, I don't really know if there is a textual variant. I think there's a suggestion I didn't do my homework here, but the word potter, yotzer, it could be that it's a misspelling of otzer, which is treasury. So this would read, throw it to the treasury, that magnificent price at which I was valued. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the treasury in the house of the Lord. So that's also a possible reading. And I bring it up because it's relevant even in the Matthew text. Okay, so you can see this is what we were quoting in Matthew, right? Yeah. Okay, let's try Jeremiah 32. To get to Jeremiah 32, we're going to have to back up several centuries. And before Zechariah, even before his time, we're backing up, you know, a generation before Zechariah was prophesying. So if we come back to Jeremiah 32, we were talking about this passage last week. Do you remember what was going on? Jeremiah's been in all sorts of trouble. They've been throwing him in pits and in prison and so on and so forth. And he's finally got a pretty good situation where he's simply under house arrest in the house of the palace guard. And then the word of the Lord comes to him while he's under arrest here. And we'll start reading in Jeremiah 32, verse 2. It says, now at that time the army of the king of Babylon was besieging Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the guard, which was in the house of the king of Judah. Because Zedekiah kept saying, why do you keep saying nasty things about me? And why do you keep predicting our doom? And it says in verse 6, Jeremiah said, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, behold, Hanamel, the son of Shallum, your uncle, is coming to you, saying, buy for yourself my field, which is at Anathot, for you have the right of redemption to buy it. Now this is a terrible deal. We talked about this a little bit last week. You don't want to buy a piece of property while there's a foreign army occupying it. It's a bad land transaction that God is suggesting Jeremiah. Yeah, why don't you buy this piece of property? There's going to be no... Jeremiah's been prophesying the destruction of Jerusalem and a complete deportation of the population. There's going to be no land titles or anything like that. But it says, this is what God tells him to do. So it says, then Hanamel, my uncle's son, came to me in the court of the guard, saying, guard, according to the word of the Lord, and said to me, buy my field, that is, at Anathoth, which is in the land of Benjamin, for you have the right of possession, and the redemption is yours. Buy it for yourself. Now, what is this right of redemption? This is what we learn about in Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25 says that you can't sell the land permanently, and if you lose the land in some sort of foreclosure type of thing, your next of kin, it's his responsibility to buy it back. The idea is that God wants the land allotted to the tribes to stay within the tribal families, to stay within the clan. And if nobody does, if let's say that you were a landowner and you were the last in your line and you fell into financial hard times, you lost your piece of property or you had to sell it for some other reason, and none of your cousins or your uncles or your brothers or anyone related to you was willing to buy the land or able to buy the land, then once every 50 years there's a jubilee year and the land automatically reverts to you. That's the whole jubilee thing. So that's what's going on here. Jeremiah is the next of kin on this piece of property. So he has a responsibility, sort of, to redeem this piece of property. So he says, the right of redemption is yours. So Hanamel comes and says everything that God told him he was going to say to Jeremiah. And Jeremiah says, then I knew that this was the word of the Lord. I bought the field, which was at Anathoth from Hanamel, my uncle's son, and I weighed out the silver for him. How much silver? Yeah, not 30 shekels, 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed, called witnesses, weighed out the silver on scales, and so on. And then I wrote it all down and recorded the transaction. And the Lord wants him to do this just as a sign, as a prophetic sign, that property will again be bought and sold in Judah by Jewish people. Okay, that's our three passages. We got a triad of passages. We have Matthew, who's looking at the Zechariah passage, but he thinks he's looking at the Jeremiah passage, apparently. But you can see why he would be thinking of the Jeremiah passage, because that's where a field is being bought, right? All right, so there's, in terms of critical scholarship, there are two possible explanations for Matthew's gaffe. The first is that it's Matthew's error. That Matthew, just like I said, he thought he was quoting Jeremiah, but it was actually Zechariah. The second is that it's a scribal error. That perhaps a scribe wanted to add the name of the prophet and added the wrong name. Nobody attributes this as an error to the master, because it's not even on his lips. I mean, it's just Matthew's commentary, right? Matthew's just offering a little prophetic insight, like he likes to do. And he does this throughout the book of Matthew. Starts out, we've already seen a couple of them. He does this all the way through the book of Matthew. So those are the critical explanations. Matthew, oops, or a later scribe made a mistake, okay? Then last week we talked about a few apologetic explanations. And going from the least likely to the most likely, they were as follows. That there actually is a lost text of Jeremiah somewhere out there that says this. And it just, you know, it disappeared. That happens. That does happen. And the Dead Sea Scrolls have proven that to us, that happens. So, but it would be really super weird if that lost Jeremiah text was actually the same as the Zechariah text. So that seems unlikely. If there was no other text, if it was just coming out of nowhere, I'd say it's likely. But it's not coming out of nowhere, it's coming out of Zechariah. All right? Second one was the explanation that the Jeremiah actually is a synonym for all the prophets, because some collections of the canon begin with the prophet Jeremiah. What did we say about that? We said that doesn't work. because it never happens anyplace else. You never see that anywhere in rabbinic literature or in the New Testament at all, or in the Church Fathers for that matter. Nobody ever calls the prophets Jeremiah. So that's a stretch, you know? Okay. The third one, and this was the one I liked, was that there is a source compendium that Matthew is drawing from, which combines different prophecies that are fulfilled in some way or another in the life of Messiah. And Matthew has this source, and he's incorporating these into his gospel. And so this was an explanation suggested by a scholar who looked at this. And I liked it because it sounded to me really plausible in terms of the way that we see Matthew and all the synoptic gospel writers, you know, all the gospel writers composing. So to review that a little bit, and I know it seems like maybe we're getting a little bit off the subject of 26 reasons, but not at all. This is really, really critical to dealing with these gospel objections in 26 reasons. We're not off the subject. Our gospel writers did use sources. How do we know? What do you think? Yes, they quote sources. For sure they quote the Tanakh. But how do we know that they're not just sitting down writing from memory and then we saw them walking on the water or something like this, but that they're actually using other sources to put... Luke says he does, exactly. Right off the bat, Luke says, you know, I compiled a lot of sources. Everybody else had kind of messed it up and I wanted to get the story straight, so I compiled a lot of sources. That's kind of the introduction of Luke, isn't it? So Luke says he used sources, and what else? How else do we know? Remember we talked about the Q document? This is how the synoptics works. Synoptic, you can figure out what that means. Syn is same, and like synonym, and optic is eye. So synoptic is see the same, seen the same. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, they're all pretty much the same. They're seen the same. They see the same. They seem the same. But they are different, aren't they? Mark is, most according to most scholars, except those of the Jerusalem Synoptic School, under, we'll just forget about that for a second, but... Most scholars believe that Mark is the first one. We talked about how in church tradition, John Mark, the disciple of Peter, writes out the Gospel of Mark for the Roman believers. Luke and Matthew, both, as they sit down to write their version of the Gospel, they have a copy of Mark. And that's their mother text. And that's what creates the synoptic effect. It's like, well, this seems a lot like what I read, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, because they're both copying from, so you got a picture of the pyramid. Here's Mark, and then over here, Matthew and Luke copying from Mark. However, there's another point on this square now, I don't know, whatever it is, trapezoid. And that is that Matthew and Luke have another shared source that Mark doesn't have. How can we tell? Because they have identical material from each other that they're drawing from someplace else. But scholars can tell that they're not copying each other, incredibly. I don't know how they do that. But they can tell that they share yet another source. What is this source? It is the stuff that is in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. That's what it is. Okay. And we call that Q. That source is called Q. So these are written sources. Mark is a written source, and Q is a written source. So we already know that we're dealing with written sources. Now, Matthew is supposed to according to church tradition, have not even been written in Greek. According to church tradition, the original real Gospel of Matthew, we don't even have. Church tradition says the real Gospel of Matthew was written by, who that was actually written by Matthew, the disciple of the Master, was written in Hebrew or Aramaic, because the church fathers called Aramaic Hebrew. But it could have been either. Could have been either Hebrew or Aramaic. That's the real Matthew. So it's possible that our Matthew also has Hebrew Matthew. And he's using Hebrew Matthew as yet another source, and that might be why Greek Matthew gets the name Matthew, because he's borrowing from Hebrew Matthew. Make sense? All right. No? Okay. I'm suggesting that the Greek Gospel of Matthew that's in our Bibles, that the guy who wrote this, he had Mark, he had Q, and Q might be Hebrew Matthew, or a translation of it. If not, he might have had yet another document that was Hebrew Matthew, or a translation of Hebrew Matthew. And because he has this access to this source, that's why his gospel picks up the name Matthew. Even though it's not Matthew, it's Mark with a bunch of other stuff. You know, right?
Would have been the translation in Greek, what would have been Matthew in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. He took on that responsibility but called it Matthew because he made the Greek translation.
Yes, except that he didn't. That would be exactly correct, except that he didn't do that. He started with Mark as his base text. So that's why I'm suggesting it's called Matthew, why Matthew is called Matthew. All right, why am I telling you all this? To confuse you? No. I want you to love the Gospels. I want you to love them and to just want to wallow in them and compare them and take delight in saying, oh, but Matthew has this, but Luke has this, and you know, just to revel in every discrepancy and not let this guy freak you out when he says, well, you know, Matthew has it this way and Luke has it this way and Mark has it that way. It's like, yeah, that's the whole reason we have multiple gospels, is, you know, because the church fathers said, look, all these are valuable. All of these preserve valuable, authentic traditions of the apostolic community. All right, so that's why I'm telling you that. And I'm also telling you this in order to help us solve our Jeremiah Zechariah riddle. Yes?
Would it be accurate then, given that explanation, to call aspects of the Gospels sort of a research paper?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yep.
Dan, this is kind of fascinating because everything you're telling me I heard in seminary, but your explanation of it is better than most of the professors I had.
See? Now you guys should remember how much you would pay for a seminary class, and you don't forget that box by the door.
In the 1800s, the Germans were kicking this around and doing a lot of research on this, and the reason they called it Q is because in German the word for source is Quelle.
Right, that's right.
You know, they weren't using any big highfalutin term. There's got to be another Quelle, another source, and it became called Q.
Which is short for source.
Mm-hmm. These are actual documents. Is this source, this Q source, actually a physical document that can be...
Not anymore, no. It does not exist. It did. We can surmise that it did exist because they're both drawing from it.
Yeah, look for it.
Well, you know, we're looking. All we seem to find is those stupid Gnostic Gospels, but...
The one thing that you mentioned about Matthew and Luke where they're quoting it, but they can't say for sure why, I can't remember which one is which, but Matthew or Luke prefers direct discourse, and the other one prefers indirect discourse as they quote from Q. So their wording is different in the Greek, but it's so very similar.
Yeah.
Direct versus indirect, and it's you know, very minor differences.
Right, yeah, and these guys who do this kind of work are extremely, extremely smart. Yeah, mm-hmm, yes. Well, so this is a little bit of how we got our Gospels, at least our Synoptic Gospels. But there's one more layer here that needs to be added, and that is the strength of oral tradition. That also, at this time, there is a lot of oral tradition floating around. And any one of the Gospel writers will pick up these oral traditions and also incorporate those into his text. Now, that's the Gospels. Let's take a look at the Apostles and the Prophets. A couple texts. Flip around with me. Go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10. And somebody shall read that nice and loud. Really loud so that it picks up on this recorder.
1 Peter 1:10.
Yes.
As to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful search and inquiry, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves,
yes,
but you. In these things which now have been announced to you through those who preach the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look.
Okay, this is great, because what you just read is the apostolic era hermeneutic, the way that they looked at the Bible. They looked at it this way. They said, the writers of the Bible, yes, they were writing about literal things and that sort of thing in their day and age and making prophecies and predictions, but within them, within each of the prophets, the Spirit of Messiah was also writing to you and to me, because we live at the culmination of the ages, the days of the coming of Messiah. And so everything that's written beforehand, Paul says it this way, everything that was written beforehand was written to instruct you. And in the book of Acts, he says, Peter says in the book of Acts, he says, of him, of Messiah, all the prophets bear witness. So the idea is that everything must be relevant in some way or another to this generation, the apostolic generation. So I'll give you an example of how they did this. In Acts chapter 1, what did we say about that? We said that doesn't work because it never happens anyplace else. You never see that anywhere in rabbinic literature or in the New Testament at all, or in the Church Fathers for that matter. Nobody ever calls the prophets Jeremiah. So that's a stretch, you know? Okay. The third one, and this was the one I liked, was that there is a source compendium that Matthew is drawing from, which combines different prophecies that are fulfilled in some way or another in the life of Messiah. And Matthew has this source, and he's incorporating these into his gospel. And so this was an explanation suggested by a scholar who looked at this. And I liked it because it sounded to me really plausible in terms of the way that we see Matthew and all the synoptic gospel writers, you know, all the gospel writers composing. So to review that a little bit, and I know it seems like maybe we're getting a little bit off the subject of 26 reasons, but not at all. This is really, really critical to dealing with these gospel objections in 26 reasons. We're not off the subject. Our gospel writers did use sources. How do we know? What do you think? Yes, they quote sources. For sure they quote the Tanakh. But how do we know that they're not just sitting down writing from memory and then we saw them walking on the water or something like this? But that they're actually using other sources to put...
Who said he did?
Luke says he does, exactly. Right off the bat, Luke says, you know, I compiled a lot of sources. Everybody else had kind of messed it up, and I wanted to get the story straight, so I compiled a lot of sources. That's kind of the introduction of Luke, isn't it? So Luke says he used sources, and what else? How else do we know? Remember we talked about the Q document? This is how the synoptics works. Synoptic, you can figure out what that means. Syn is same, and like synonym, and optic is eye, so synoptic is see the same, seen the same. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, they're all pretty much the same. They're seen the same. They see the same. They seem the same. But they are different, aren't they? Mark is, most according to most scholars, except those of the Jerusalem Synoptic School, under, we'll just forget about that for a second, but most scholars believe that Mark is the first one. We talked about how in church tradition, John Mark, the disciple of Peter, writes out the Gospel of Mark for the Roman believers. Luke and Matthew, both, as they sit down to write their version of the Gospel, they have a copy of Mark. And that's their mother text. And that's what creates the synoptic effect. It's like, well, this seems a lot like what I read, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, because they're both copying from, so you got a picture of the pyramid. Here's Mark. And then over here, Matthew and Luke copying from Mark. However, there's another point on this square now. I don't know. Whatever it is, trapezoid. And that is that Matthew and Luke have another shared source that Mark doesn't have. How can we tell? Because they have identical material from each other that they're drawing from someplace else. But scholars can tell that they're not copying each other, incredibly. I don't know how they do that. But they can tell that they share yet another source. What is this source? It is the stuff that is in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. That's what it is. Okay. And we call that Q. That source is called Q. So these are written sources. Mark is a written source, and Q is a written source. So we already know that we're dealing with written sources. Now, Matthew is supposed to, according to church tradition, have not even been written in Greek. According to church tradition, the original real Gospel of Matthew, we don't even have. Church tradition says the real Gospel of Matthew was written by, that was actually written by Matthew, the disciple of the Master, was written in Hebrew, or Aramaic, because the church fathers called Aramaic Hebrew. But it could have been either. Could have been either Hebrew or Aramaic. That's the real Matthew. So it's possible that our Matthew also has Hebrew Matthew. And he's using Hebrew Matthew as yet another source, and that might be why Greek Matthew gets the name Matthew, because he's borrowing from Hebrew Matthew. Make sense? All right. No? Okay. I'm suggesting that the Greek Gospel of Matthew that's in our Bibles, that the guy who wrote this, he had Mark, he had Q, and Q might be Hebrew Matthew, or translation of it. If not, he might have had yet another document that was Hebrew Matthew, or a translation of Hebrew Matthew. And because he has this access to this source, that's why his Gospel picks up the name Matthew. Even though it's not Matthew, it's Mark with a bunch of other stuff. You know, right?
Would have been the translation in Greek, what would have been Matthew in Hebrew? Mm-hmm. He took on that responsibility but called it Matthew because he made the Greek translation.
Yes, except that he didn't. That would be exactly correct. except that he didn't do that. He started with Mark as his base text. So that's why I'm suggesting it's called Matthew. Why Matthew is called Matthew. All right. Why am I telling you all this? To confuse you? No. I want you to love the Gospels. I want you to love them and to just want to wallow in them and compare them and take delight in saying, oh, but Matthew has this, but Luke has this, and you know, just to revel in every discrepancy and not let this guy freak you out when he says, well, you know, Matthew has it this way and Luke has it this way and Mark has it that way. It's like, yeah, that's the whole reason we have multiple Gospels, is, you know, because the Church Fathers said, look, all these are valuable. All of these preserve valuable, authentic traditions of the apostolic community. All right, so that's why I'm telling you that. And I'm also telling you this in order to help us solve our Jeremiah Zechariah riddle. Yes?
Would it be accurate then, given that explanation, to call aspects of the Gospels sort of a research paper?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yep.
Dan, this is kind of fascinating because everything you're telling me I heard in seminary, but your explanation of it is better than most of the professors I had.
See? Now you guys should remember how much you would pay for a seminary class, and you don't forget that box by the door.
In the 1800s, the Germans were kicking this around and doing a lot of research on this. And the reason they called it Q is because in German, the word for source is Quelle.
Right, that's right.
You know, they weren't using any big highfalutin term. They, well, there's got to be another Quelle, another source, and it became called Q.
Which is short for source.
Mm-hmm. Said that these are actual documents. Is this source, this Q source, actually a physical document that can be...
Not anymore. No. It does not exist. It did. We can surmise that it did exist because they're both drawing from it.
Well,
you know, we keep looking. We're looking. All we seem to find is those stupid Gnostic Gospels, but...
The one thing that you mentioned about Matthew and Luke where they're quoting it but they can't say for sure why, I can't remember which one is which, but Matthew... or Luke prefers direct discourse, and the other one prefers indirect discourse, as they quote from Q. So their wording is different in the Greek, but it's so very similar.
Yeah.
Direct versus indirect, and it's you know, very minor differences.
Right. Yeah. And these guys who do this kind of work are extremely, extremely smart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, so this is a little bit of how we got our Gospels, at least our Synoptic Gospels. But there's one more layer here that needs to be added, and that is the strength of oral tradition. That also, at this time, there is a lot of oral tradition floating around. And any one of the Gospel writers will pick up these oral traditions and also incorporate those into his text. Now, that's the Gospels. Let's take a look at the Apostles and the Prophets. A couple texts. Flip around with me. Go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10. And somebody shall read that nice and loud. Really loud so that it picks up on this recorder.
1 Peter 1:10.
Yes.
As to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful search and inquiry, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves,
yes,
but you. In these things which now have been announced to you through those who preach the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look.
Okay, this is great, because what you just read is the apostolic era hermeneutic, the way that they looked at the Bible. They looked at it this way. They said, the writers of the Bible, yes, they were writing about literal things and that sort of thing in their day and age and making prophecies and predictions, but within them, within each of the prophets, the Spirit of Messiah was also writing to you and to me, because we live at the culmination of the ages, the days of the coming of Messiah. And so everything that's written beforehand, Paul says it this way, everything that was written beforehand was written to instruct you. And in the book of Acts, he says, Peter says in the book of Acts, he says, of him, of Messiah, all the prophets bear witness. So the idea is that everything must be relevant in some way or another to this generation, the apostolic generation. So I'll give you an example of how they did this in Acts chapter 1.